Okay, so the next sutta here is called the Shorter Discourse on the Simile of the Elephant's Footprint, I think. And this sutta here is, in a way, it is very similar to the previous sutta. It's a similar kind of theme. It shows you the path from the very beginning all the way to the very end. The difference is that this one here shows it in much more detail, and it shows, in a sense, what you have to do, how you have to practice, all the way from the beginning, all the way to the end. And this particular sutta is often known, this particular structure is known as the gradual training in the suttas, in the sense that it's gradual training. It shows you step by step what you actually have to do. So this sutta, it begins with a man who has gone and he has met the Buddha. And then on the way back from the Buddha, he meets another person. And then he praises the Buddha to this other person. Oh, the Buddha, what this amazing, amazing man I have just met. He praises the Buddha to this other person. And this other man says, well, why are you praising this Buddha so much? What's the reason for all this praise? And the answer he gives, he says that, well, when people go to the Buddha, you know, people who are very sharp, very smart people, very good at talking, etc., when they have a discussion, what happens is that not only do they get persuaded by the Buddha that, you know, the Dhamma is right, the Dhamma is the way to practice, not just that, but often they actually become the disciples of the Buddha, and then they ordain in his teaching. And then this other man is very impressed when he hears this, because India is always a very kind of, it's a very strong debating culture, everybody debating with each other. And if one person always wins the debate, it must mean that he has something special, right? And then this man, he goes to the Buddha, and he tells the Buddha the conversation he just had with this other man. And of course, the Buddha says, well, basically the Buddha says, that's nothing. So, and then the Buddha explains to him what the Dhamma really is about. It's not about winning an argument. It's nice to win an argument if it persuades somebody else and that gives them something good. It's great. But of course, it's much, much more than that. And the Buddha uses the simile of the elephant's footprint. And the simile of the elephant's footprint is, if you see something which is which looks like something, then like an elephant's footprint, when you see an elephant footprint in the wood, you don't straight away assume that this must be a large elephant. What you assume that this is a large footprint. And then what you have to do is you have to get more evidence, right? So you have to accumulate more evidence. So you see the footprint, so you follow that footprint and you see another one. And then perhaps you see some other things. You see like some branches that have been broken off, this sutta talks about. Or you see some scrapings on the tree that have been done by the tusks of an elephant. So you keep on accumulating evidence, more and more evidence, until eventually, when you keep on following the footprint, eventually you see that elephant sitting there on the ground, walking about or lying down or whatever. And then only when you actually see that elephant, then you know, okay, this is a large bull elephant. And it's the same thing with Buddhism. And this shows you something about how we know things in the Buddhist teachings. It's exactly the same thing here. You may come to a beautiful sutta. Perhaps you see an inspiring teacher somewhere. All these things are evidence that there might be something there. But you cannot come to the conclusion on that basis that there is something profound going on. So the Buddhist theory of knowledge is that, yes, okay, you then have some confidence, you see something which seems right, so confidence arises in you. Then as a result of that confidence, you then start the practice, which are a result of that confidence. And then gradually, stage by stage, you follow through this practice until the time comes when you also have these profound experiences are enough to convince you that there's something here. And then when you have that same insight, the same understanding that the Buddha had, only then do you know that the teaching is correct. This is a very, I think, important difference between Buddhism, early Buddhism, and most other religions, if you like. In Buddhism, we accept that in the beginning, we are acting on confidence. We're acting on faith, if you like. I prefer the word confidence. We're acting on faith. And because we know it is faith, we don't care so much if other people challenge us. It's okay to challenge us. As long as you only have confidence in something, you could be wrong, right? So if you could be wrong, if other people challenge you, maybe they have a point. And it's a very kind of freeing thing. You feel very free about it. If somebody challenges you, okay, it doesn't really matter. It's not an important thing here, because you understand that you haven't got those grounds for certainty regardless. So we make a distinction in Buddhism between confidence on the one hand and true, real knowledge on the other hand. So keep that in mind. If you keep that in mind, it actually is quite freeing. It's quite nice to understand that distinction, because it means that you are much more at ease with the whole teaching of Buddhism or the teaching of anything whatsoever. Okay, so let's have a look now at how the Buddha, how this gradual training actually works. How you gradually move along, if you like, you move along the footprints and you start to understand these teachings. Let's see how it works. So I'm going to start a little bit further down, Edgar. I'm not going to start at the beginning, because I'm going to start where it says, Sotri Brahman here at the Tathagata appears in the world. Can you see that? Yeah, okay. So that's where I'm going to start off. Okay, so this is how the gradual training is described in Buddhism. And this is probably one of the most important suttas, one of the most important frameworks in all the suttas. And the reason why it is so important is because it occurs so many times. It occurs again and again and again. So what that means is that the Buddha must have taught it very often and very regularly. So if you want to understand what are the important teachings in the suttas, you have to ask yourself, what did the Buddha teach often? That must be the most important part. Okay, so this is how it goes. So too, Brahmin, here a Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully awakened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime, knower of the worlds, incomparable leaders of persons to be tamed, teachers of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. He declares this world with its gods, its Maras and its Brahmas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end, with the right meaning and phrasing. And he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Okay. So this part, this is what we're seeing right here, the first very line there, from a Tathagata appears in the world to enlightened and blessed. That part there is part of the standard recollection you hear, the recollection of the Buddha that you will hear in any Buddhist country. This is that particular part. So this is, I don't know if some of you may have heard this chanting. It's chanting is Iti Piso Bhagava Arahang Samma Sambuddho Vichara Charana Sampanno. This is a standard recollection. And the purpose of this recollection, if you use this recollection wisely, it gives you a sense of who the Buddha actually was. And if you really understand who the Buddha was, it gives you a sense of, again, a sense of happiness in a way, that there is such a being in the world. So thinking about these things in the right way, if you think about it in the right way, it actually becomes another tool to use in the meditation practice. So the first thing here, it says that a Tathagata appears in the world. It sounds a little bit, perhaps, when you read it like that, it sounds almost like a bit mystical. But actually, the meaning of this is simply that a person somewhere actually makes a breakthrough to understand things as they actually are. And the point here is that the Tathagata or Buddha is an ordinary person, just like everybody else. It's just that for some reason he has done the right, he, maybe she perhaps as well, has done the right thing, so that he has been able to make that breakthrough and see the world as it actually is. So it is a natural process. It has happened every now and again. If you look at world history in a very large perspective, every now and again there will be somebody who has the right qualities, who will be able to make that breakthrough. So every now and again there will be a person who is able to make that breakthrough. A purely natural process. And because it is a natural process, there's nothing supernatural or strange about this. It's just how the world works in a way. So a Tathagata appearing in the world, a Tathagata then is somebody who sees the world as it actually is. And this is what is really important here, the idea of seeing the world as it actually is. Because the problem is that if you don't understand the world as it actually is, you're going to make wrong decisions, right? It's a bit like you can imagine yourself, you want to invest some money on the stock market, but all the information you have is wrong. So because all the information you have is wrong, you will invest the money on the wrong stock. Because you invest in the wrong stock, the stock market goes down. And before you know it, you've lost half the money you invested. And it's exactly the same thing in life, right? If you invest all your intentions, if you invest your life in the wrong way, you know, if you do all the wrong things, you're not going to get the results that you want. But when you see the world clearly, when someone sees the world clearly, then you have a chance to act on that clear information, and then you can do what is right, or what is wise, what will actually give the good results. So this is why a Buddha is so important, right? Because the idea of Buddha means somebody who is awake, somebody who has seen the world for what it actually is. That's why this idea is so important, because then it gives the chance for other beings to understand and see things as they actually are. The Buddha is, in a sense, like the arising of right view, of right understanding here. So right view comes into existence. That's what it means that the Buddha arises in the world. Right view comes into existence. And when that right view comes into existence, it can be shared with all other beings. That's why the Buddha is sometimes called the eye of the world, right? He's the eye of the world because he sees. And because he sees, he can pass it on to other people. The eye of the world, that's what the Buddha is. The idea of awakening is in the suttas. It's often it's compared to the idea of turning on the light, right? Before you were in darkness, now you are in light. That's one way it is explained. Another way that the idea of awakening is explained is like being a chicken. When you're a chicken inside the shell, inside the egg, and everything is very confined. You can't see, you don't know what's going on. And it's like breaking out of the shell, and suddenly you can see the world for the first time. So this is the idea of the Tathagata, the Buddha, appearing in the world. So the interesting thing here, of course, is that this whole gradual training, the whole path of Buddhism, depends on the Tathagata arising in the world. This is the very first step. Without that, there is no training at all, basically. So very important, that the very idea that, you know, Buddha actually has to rise for even this training to come into existence. The Buddha is like the existence of a Buddha is the foundation for that thing to be possible. So it then has the next word here is accomplished. The word accomplished in Pali is arahant, the word arahant. And the word arahant, actually the meaning of that word is somebody who is like worthy, somebody who is deserving here. Why are they worthy? And the reason they are worthy, or why they are deserving here, what they are worthy of things like respect, right? They're worthy of our generosity. They're worthy of being listened to. Because if somebody has right view about something, if somebody understands the world as it actually is, and somebody has the ability to impart that to you, so that you can act in accordance with that to reduce your suffering and increase your happiness, then they have like the key, the secret to the meaning of life. So if somebody has the secret, if somebody has the answer to that, what you're really looking for, if they really have that, then that is really worthy of respect, right? It's really worthy of honor. It's really worthy of support and worthy of listening to and taking as your teacher. So that is the idea of arahant. Then you have the idea of fully awakened, appears in the world, arahant, fully awakened. And fully awakened is this thing I was talking about before, having understood and seen the world as it actually is. Perfect in true knowledge and conduct. True knowledge is here, is different from ordinary knowledge. Ordinary knowledge is the thing you get by reading books, right? You get knowledge about this, knowledge about that, knowledge about, you know, the geography of the countries in the world, knowledge about mathematics or engineering or whatever it is. But this is knowledge of a very different type. This is like a deep existential knowledge that has to do with who we are as human beings. And because it is a deep existential knowledge, because it concerns our very essence of what we are as humans, once you see that, it also affects affects your conduct as well, right? If you see something very profound, it should change the way you act, the way you are as a human being. And that's why the Buddha is somebody who is perfect, not just in knowledge, but also in conduct at the same time. And this is quite important, because what that means is that it is possible, at least to some extent, to just judge somebody by their external behavior. If somebody truly is awakened, if somebody truly is a Buddha, if somebody is enlightened, it will affect how they act. So it's possible if you have any doubts about somebody's spiritual attainments, about somebody's spiritual qualifications, one of the most important ways of deciding that is to look at them and look at their conduct. And so what we have to look for is if somebody is awakened, they don't have any anger, right? They don't have any greed. What they have is the opposite. They have endless generosity. They have endless kindness. They have endless compassion. And of course, they also have wisdom. And this, of course, is very important, because what it means is that there is a way of knowing. There is a way of knowing whether somebody actually has something. If that wasn't the case, then it would be impossible for the Buddha to teach other people. So you can use that also in your present life if you want to decide. Sometimes we always ask the question, how do you know whether somebody is enlightened? How do you know whether somebody has profound wisdom? And this is how you know. So it's always good to judge these things, to look at people, to see whether they are acting in the right way, doing the right thing. And this is how you can make some sort of preliminary judgment about whether somebody is really who they claim to be, or whether they are a teacher who really has that insight which the Buddha also had. So knowledge and conduct always goes together here. Then it says here, the Buddha is sublime. And again, the idea of sublime is something which is very elevated, something very noble, something very beautiful. Like the highest kind of human being, right? Then we have the knower of the worlds. And the knower of the world, again, is just understanding how the world functions. And a large part of that, from a Buddhist point of view, is the idea of karma and rebirth. Of course, the idea, if you see something like rebirth, if you see that for yourself, and you see the operation of rebirth, how it functions according to the laws of karma, that actually affects you very strongly on how you relate to the world. You understand all the possibilities of life, and you also understand the limitations of life. So once you have that data which the Buddha has, then you can make again the right decisions according to that data. And then it says the Buddha is the incomparable leader of persons to be tamed. First of all, to be tamed, I don't think is a very good translation. I think it's better to say something like tameable, so incomparable leaders of tameable persons. So the idea behind this, of course, again, if you have seen the way the world actually is, if you understand the world, then you have the ability to help others as well. This is the idea here. And the idea that persons are tameable, the idea there is that there are certain people who are ready to hear a profound message, right? Certain people are able to take it to heart because they are mature enough in a spiritual way or whatever. But there are some people who are not mature enough. You can see that, myself, I teach Buddhism to quite a large number of people, and most of the people who come and listen, they are interested. But there are some people who just can't get it. They're not interested. If you try to tell them about kindness, they don't even want to hear about it. So these are the sort of people who are not tameable, right, in the Buddhist sense. And often one of the biggest problems with not being tameable is if you have like a wrong view. If you have some very strong idea, for example, you are a very staunch Muslim, or perhaps a very staunch Christian, and you believe in God. Now, those kind of views are often very, very powerful. And there is no way that some people will be willing or able to let go of those views. So what we are taming here, we're taming the mind, right? We're bringing the mind into peace as the tamed mind. That's what we mean by tameable. Then the next one here is, I'm going to go a bit quickly because we're already running out of time, unfortunately. But the next one here is teacher of gods and humans. And this means that the Buddha does not just teach human beings, he teaches other beings as well, wherever they might be. And this is actually quite an important point. Sometimes you will hear in Buddhist circles, people will say, you have to be careful to get reborn again as a human in your next life, because if you don't get reborn as a human, then you won't make any progress in the Dhamma practice. But actually, from the way the Buddha speaks, he doesn't actually say that. What he says is that, you just go along with the flow. You allow the karma, whatever karma you have, you allow the karma to drive you forward in the right way. And then if you get reborn in the right place, then there will very often be Buddhist teachings available in that place. So that is quite nice. But sometimes you get this idea as a Buddhist that you have to guide your rebirth towards a human existence, etc. But these are actually later ideas that came a long time after the Buddha. And then the last two words here, enlightened and blessed. And I enlightened again just means awakened, just like we saw before. And the last word, blessed, is just basically like a title. It's Bhagavan, probably like a title that is given to somebody who is like a special spiritual teacher. Okay, good. That's more than enough probably already. So let's take another break and do some meditation and have a bit of tea, and then we'll see you back here again later on. So let's start there. So we are looking at the what is called in English usually the gradual training. So this is like the whole sequence of training from the beginning all the way to the end of the Buddha's path. And this is probably, as I said yesterday, probably one of the most important expositions that the Buddha actually gives in the suttas. So it starts off with the Buddha, the Tathagata, arising in the world, realizing awakening. And then the next thing then is how the Buddha then expresses that teaching to the world. And the way that is spoken about here, it says that he declares this world with its gods, its maras, its brahmas, this generation with its recluses and brahmins, its princes, I think its gods is better, its gods and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. And the idea behind this, the idea, the Buddha is actually saying here, he's saying that he has understood the world, right? He has seen the world in all this diversity, so he has the implication here is also the understanding of rebirth, and understanding the law of karma, and understanding the kind of the scope and the entire possibilities, if you like, in the world. So once you understand that, if you understand karma and you understand rebirth, then that has important consequences. And this is why this is called then right view in Buddhism, because that then leads on to something more beyond that. And then it says that he teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And the idea of Dhamma here is mostly to do with the path of practice, right? So the path is good in the beginning. In other words, it gives good results in the beginning. It gives good results in the middle, and it gives good results in the end. So this is mostly about the path of practice. And it has the right meaning and right phrasing. Right meaning here means that it has a purpose, right? It has a goal. It's going towards something positive. It's going towards something which people actually want. And this is the whole path. And it also has the right phrasing in the sense that the Buddha doesn't speak. The Dhamma is not just, he doesn't talk carelessly. He talks with care. So you can assume that when it's phrased in a certain way, that phrasing will have a certain meaning. So the phrasing is always is a carefully chosen wording here. And then the last part here, he reveals a holy life, or if you like, maybe a spiritual life that is utterly perfect and pure. It is perfect in the sense that it contains all the factors that is necessary for the practice. And it's pure in the sense that it takes you all the way to awakening, to understanding the same thing that the Buddha saw. Okay, so next we go on. Next thing it says, I'm going to go a little bit faster at this point, so let's see how things go. So, a householder or householder's son, or one born in some other clan, hears that Dhamma. On hearing the Dhamma, he acquires confidence in the Tathagata, in the Buddha. Possessing that confidence, he considers thus, household life is crowded and dusty, life gone forth is wide open. It is not easy while living in a home to lead the holy life or the spiritual life utterly pure and perfect as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. On a later occasion, abandoning a small or a large fortune, abandoning a small or a large circle of relatives, he shaves off his hair and beard, puts on the yellow or the ochre robe, and goes forth from home life into homelessness. Okay. So is the translation good? People happy with the translation? Yeah? Okay, really, it's good. People are happy. Okay. This is then what happens. You know, the Buddha then teaches the Dhamma, and people, when they hear this, they recognize there's something profound here, right? So when you hear the Dhamma, you gain a sense of confidence in these teachings. And the way it is phrased here, it seems very simple, right? You just hear the Dhamma and you acquire confidence on that basis. But of course, this often takes time. You hear the Dhamma, you hear it a bit more, you hear, and gradually you come to acquire confidence. And that's the way it should be. It shouldn't be too fast. If it is too fast, it may be something which isn't quite right. But if it is a gradual approach, that is the way we should do this. So you consider it, you reflect on the Dhamma, you consider this. This is one of the important things in the Buddha's teaching which people often forget about. When you read the sutta, you often reflect about it afterwards. What does it actually mean? What is the purpose of this? And then when you reflect on it, and you compare it to your own experience of life and what life is like, that is when gradually, slowly, you start to understand that there is something profound here, there's something beautiful here, or if you can't relate to it, you reject it. And an important part of this is, of course, also the idea that you watch the Buddha, right? You see somebody who is spiritually advanced or spiritually awakened. You actually watch them and you look. Does this person have the qualities that they're supposed to have? And of course, in Buddhism, if somebody is really awakened, they're not supposed to get angry. They're not supposed to be greedy. They're not supposed to be confused and deluded, right? So you watch for these things. And then you see when there is when the teaching and the quality of the person match, they go together. That, of course, then gives rise to, gradually gives rise to confidence. And that's once you get that confidence, that is when you might decide to go forth and become a monk. And that's what happens next year. So remember that this sutta is about the path all the way to awakening. And that's why it has the going forth, the becoming a monastic at this point. It doesn't mean that you have to become a monastic. It just means that because this sutta is about the path all the way to awakening, that's why this is included here. So you notice he says here that the way you think is you think that, you know, our life, you know, household life is crowded and dusty. And of course in those days, you know, people would have very large families. You know, it's not that long ago that even in Norway, if I look at my grandparents, they often had very large families, right? And this was also the case in those days. You often had lots of children. The houses weren't particularly large. And dusty here, the idea of dust is a reference to defilements. So because of family life, because of all these things, defilements are much more prone to arise. Okay, so that's when he thinks that, you know, the problem in household life is too many people together, too much things happening, and it's too easy to have desires and anger when you are in a crowded situation. Whereas if you go forth, you have a bit more space, a bit more room for yourself, and it allows the defilements to die down. So when he does that and he thinks, I will shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robes, yellow perhaps ochre robes, like a, you know, brownish yellow perhaps, and he then decides to leave the home life on that basis. It's interesting here that the word for robe in Pali is vata. Vata means just cloth or clothes, right? So in those days, when somebody went forth, they became a monastic, a monk or a nun, they didn't actually have today we look really strange compared to most ordinary people with these kind of clothes. But in those days, the clothes they wore roughly the same as ordinary people. The difference was just in perhaps the style a little bit. You know, the kind of didn't have any fancy borders and that kind of thing. And the color was different. It was a very kind of simple color. And that was the difference. So it's interesting to think about that because, you know, today when you are a monk, you look so different. You look so strange in a sense. And most people, they see you, they think, oh, what's going on? At least if you're not a Buddhist. But in those days, actually, they were much more similar to ordinary people. Anyway, so then he decides to go forth. And when he goes forth, he abandons a small and a large fortune. In other words, you give up your possessions when you become a monastic. And also you leave your family, obviously. And that is what the going forth basically means. That's an interesting point because sometimes you see today, you can see monastics or monks or nuns, and sometimes they acquire so many possessions. But actually the ideal is what you see here. The ideal is to give all these things up, right? As a monastic, you're not really supposed to have any possessions. You're supposed to enjoy the simple and easy life. That's kind of part of it. So then he goes forth, he becomes a monk, and then from the next step down in the gradual training, we're going to talk about morality here. You can see here how the gradual training and the Noble Eightfold Path. Do all of you understand the Noble Eightfold Path? You know the Noble Eightfold Path is like the basic Buddha's teaching on the practice of Buddhism. And the Noble Eightfold Path starts with right view, and we have right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation at the end. And this is the Noble Eightfold Path. It's a gradual thing, stage by stage. And you can see, if you look at this gradual training here, you can see that it follows exactly the same pattern as the Noble Eightfold Path. So right view is the Buddha arising in the world, right? And then the Buddha teaching. That is like right view coming into existence. And then when somebody hears that right view, and they acquire confidence in that, then the intention arises, I want to become a monk. In this case, the intention is to become a monk. Or it can just be the intention of wanting to practice the Buddha's teaching. And then when you have that right intention, then comes morality, right? The right intention, then comes the right speech, right action, and right livelihood. And this is what we see next here in this gradual training as well. This is one of the nice things you see. Once you start to understand the Buddha's teaching, you understand that the different types of teachings he gives, like here the gradual training, the Noble Eightfold Path, you have things people mentioned yesterday, dependent origination, Four Noble Truths, you talk about the spiritual faculties, you don't have to remember all these things, Edgar, it's okay. And you have all this, when you read the suttas, you have all these different categories. And once you start to understand the teaching fully, you can see how all of these things fit together. The whole teaching fits together in a very beautiful way. The Buddha's teaching is like a whole. It's like, you can imagine almost like you have a puzzle, right? And the puzzle has all these little pieces. And when you fit it all together, when you see one piece, you don't really understand what it does. But when you fit it all together nicely, the little bits and pieces of the puzzle, then you get a nice, beautiful picture, and you can see how it all fits together. It's very useful to think like that, and useful to reflect on how it all fits together, because then you start to build up a good understanding. Okay, so he has now gone forth, he's become a monk, and now he starts to do nice things. So it says here, I will read the next paragraph, it goes as follows. Having thus gone forth and possessing the biggest training and way of life, abandoning the killing of living beings, he abstains from killing living beings with rod and weapon laid aside. Conscientious, merciful, he abides compassionate to all living beings. Abandoning the taking of what is not given, he abstains from taking what is not given. Taking only what is given, expecting only what is given. By not stealing, he abides in purity. Abandoning in celibacy, he observes celibacy, living apart, abstaining from the vulgar practice of sexual intercourse. Okay, so this is it's very interesting, this particular paragraph, because this we're now talking about Buddhist morality. Very often when people talk about morality, morality is the idea that people have that these are the things you should not be doing. And that is often how morality is defined, about the things you should not be doing. But what you're seeing here is that it's not just about the things you shouldn't be doing. That's like the negative side of morality. But it's also about the things that you should be doing. It's the positive side of morality. So not only should you avoid killing living beings, obviously also means injuring or hurting living beings. It's not only that, but you should actually have an active compassion, an active kindness towards living beings. So and this is, I think this is very important. It's something that people often forget, this other side of morality. And this other side of morality is actually very important, because if you are actively kind, this is the thing that often becomes very powerful in your mind. Kindness is something when you sit down to meditate later on, you close your eyes. This is what comes back to you when you close your eyes. When you become peaceful, the memories kind of come back to you of this, of the goodness that you have inside. And it's that impact on the mind that is made by goodness, that impact on the mind when you sit down and you are peaceful, that is what makes you feel good about yourself, right? And that goodness is then what actually makes meditation possible. So this is why this is so important, the positive side. So please, don't forget about the positive side of morality. There is another interesting thing about this, which I just want to mention very briefly. I'm not going to talk in great detail because it gets quite complicated. So that is the fact that You will notice here that the killing of living beings, it is assumed that if you are killing of living beings comes about when you are not compassionate, right? This is the assumption here. Because if you don't kill, you are compassionate. If you kill, the assumption is you're not compassionate. And that is very interesting because it means that, you know, things like, I don't know if you have this word in Latvian, but this English word, euthanasia. Euthanasia means that you can, you know, if somebody wants to die and they've had enough and you help them to die, it's often called euthanasia in English. Yeah. So euthanasia basically means that you are maybe helping somebody to die, but you're doing it out of compassion, right? Because you want to help somebody to overcome suffering. Yeah. And of course the point of that is that from this point of view, when they talk about being compassionate, if you are helping somebody to die for compassionate reasons, you will see that is not really covered by this what is here called morality. Yeah. Mm. This is very interesting because you will hear typically in traditional Buddhist circles they will say that, you know, if you kill somebody it's always bad. But when you know this teaching, the way the Buddha described these things, it actually is much more flexible in the way it looks at things. So in Buddhism, it is the intention, the motivation, why you are doing something, which is most important, right? Why are you doing something? And if you are sure that you are coming from a good place, if you are sure that you are really compassionate, it's, of course you cannot delude yourself, you cannot think, you know, you have to be very clear about your intentions. If you have doubts about your intentions, if you're not clear, it's best not to do anything. But if you're very clear that you're doing something for the right reasons, then that is what matters in Buddhism. So the idea of morality in Buddhism, or ethics in Buddhism, is a very personal thing. Nobody else can tell you whether you're doing the right, something which is right or wrong. Only you can know that, because it depends on your personal mind state. So the mind state is what decides. So there's, you know, you can kill an animal, you can kill a human being for all kinds of different reasons. And that reason that you're doing it for is more important than the actual act of killing itself. And this is something that is true for all of these, all of morality in Buddhism, whether it's killing or bad speech. It's true all the way through. It is what is driving you, what is the motivation, is more important than the act itself. So the next one here is about stealing. It's actually the way the Pali, the way it's translated, abandoning the taking of what is not given. It's just a very complicated way of saying abandoning stealing, really. basically, you don't steal. But again, remember that stealing, it depends a lot on why you do things, right? If you steal something just because you want something for yourself, of course, that is bad karma. But say that you are very, very poor, and let's say you have a small child that is starving, and you steal something, maybe even thinking, I will give it back again when I have an opportunity. That is a very different type of stealing. Usually, very often when you hear about karma, when people talk about karma, they talk about karma either as if it is either good or bad. But the idea of karma is much more complicated than that. It's not just either good or bad. There's a whole area in between, which is like, you know, either leaning towards good or leaning towards bad, but mostly neutral. And this karma is much more complicated than either good or bad. It is not like in some religions, you know, like Christianity, you know, either you break the commandment or you don't, right? Either it's good or bad. But in Buddhism, it's actually much more complicated than that. So the opposite of stealing, then, remember I was saying before about not only should you avoid doing the bad, you should be doing the good. So the opposite of stealing is obviously generosity. When you steal, you are taking something for yourself. You're being greedy. When you're giving, you're doing the opposite of being greedy. You're sharing what you have, sharing of yourself. Then we have the next precept, which is the abandoning in celibacy. Of course, what it really means is it means abandoning all kinds of sexuality. That's what it really means. And it says, the translation here, it says, in English, it has the vulgar practice. Really, a better translation would be to be the common or ordinary practice would be more appropriate translation. So this is this is like, again, we're talking about the monastic life, and that's why we're talking about here abandoning all sexual activities. So then that is the equivalent to right action on the Eightfold Path. And the next one, you come to right speech. So, I'll read through this first of all. Abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. He speaks truth, adheres to truth, is trustworthy and reliable, one who is no deceiver of the world. Abandoning malicious speech, he abstains from malicious speech. He does not repeat elsewhere what he has heard here in order to divide those people from these, nor does he repeat to these people what he has heard elsewhere in order to divide these people from those. Thus he is one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendship, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. Abandoning harsh speech, he abstains from harsh speech. He speaks such words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, and lovable, as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by many, and agreeable to many. Abandoning gossip, he abstains from gossip. He speaks at the right time what is fact, speaks on what is good, speaks on the Dhamma and the discipline. At the right time, he speaks such words that are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. So the first one here is about speaking the truth. And the point here is not only that you avoid to lie, but you also try to be straightforward. You try to say things as they actually are, without trying to kind of distort things and to give things the wrong impression, so to speak. But you will find that with false speech, just like with everything else in Buddhist morality, the reason why you say something wrong, the reason why you lie, is more important than the lying itself. And it says elsewhere in the suttas that if you lie because you want some kind of benefit for yourself, you lie because you're afraid of being told off, you lie because you want to gain something for yourself, you lie for some kind of worldly reason, because you want more respect, because whatever it is, this is when lying is particularly bad. This is like lying based on desire or based on even anger or aversion. But if you lie, say for example, you lie because you want to protect somebody, you lie because somebody may not be ready to hear something difficult. If you look inside of yourself and you know that it is coming from compassion, then it cannot be as bad as lying for your own desires, your own benefit. It's important to remember these things, because sometimes people think that, you know, lying is always bad, it is always, you always have to try to avoid these things, and it is good to avoid it, but it's also good to understand that there's a difference between different types of lying. Okay, then we have the next one here, which is the malicious speech. So this is like when you speak to, you say things which divide people, which bring people apart, which divides them. And this is like, you know, when you, even when you say something bad about something else, even something very simple, very often that tends to divide people, right? If you are upset with somebody and you say that to somebody else, it tends to divide those people apart. So the ideal kind of speech is speech which brings understanding between people, right? When people are divided, it's often because of misunderstanding, they're not able to understand each other's point of view. So by trying to explain and trying to sort of make people understand each other, you can actually unite those people who are divided. So as it says here, you become a promoter of friendships, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord, delights in concord, a speaker of words that promote concord. So very, very nice. Again, you can see here how all of these things, they have like a negative side, and then there is the positive side, where you actually are doing things that are wholesome and good. Then we have the next aspect of speech here, which is the abandoning of harsh speech. So harsh speech is speech which is like hurtful, right? Which you feel is not nice to hear. Speech which maybe is too, maybe using strong swear words, or, you know, telling people off in a bad way, or maybe shouting and these kind of things. And the opposite here, again, you can see the opposite here are words that are gentle, right? Words that are kind of soft. And it says here very nicely, pleasing to the ear, kind of things that you'd like to come into the ear, right? Lovable, things that, and it says words that go to the heart. You know, sometimes when somebody speaks, it goes to the heart, right? And it kind of feels nice when somebody says that. Words that go to the heart. So what are those kind of words? If you think about that, you will know that there are some people who are very good at speaking that kind of words, which you feel good inside of you. And remember the point here, you don't say these nice things to flatter other people. This is not about flattery. You don't say these things because you want to be liked by the other person. But the reason, again, you're saying these things is because of kindness or compassion, right? You actually want the best for the other person. So when you're speaking from that pure motive that you actually desire somebody else's good, this is like metta, right? The metta practice. This is like compassion, karuna in Pali. You're doing it for a pure motive, a pure reason. And that is when these things are very powerful. And this is, I think, one of the another important point in the Buddhist practice. You often talk about metta, or about compassion, you know, in meditation as such. But these are not things you just do in meditation. In fact, the meditation on metta, on wishing other people well, is only possible when you have practiced that metta in daily life, in act, in speech, in the way you think about other people. It's only when you do that basic kind of metta in daily life that metta and meditation really becomes powerful. Okay, so then we come to the last one, last factor of right speech. And it says here, abandoning gossip. Gossip is not a very good word. What it means is like empty talk, right? Just blabbering on about nothing. That's really what it means. Gossip in English actually means something else. It means like you're talking behind somebody's back or something. This doesn't mean that. This means like empty talk. And you can see here the way it is explained here. You speak at the right time. You know when is the right time to speak, right? And then you speak about what is useful, what is the other person is actually good for them, about what is good. You speak about the Dhamma. And very nicely towards the end here, it says that you speak words that are worthy of recording here. The Pali here is Nidanavati. Nidanavati means that it's like a treasure, right? And Nidana is a treasure. So these are words that are to be treasured. It's like you store them up inside of your mind because they are so beautiful. It's like reading the word of the Buddha. And you thought, wow, this is very nice. And you store it up inside to then bring it out at the right time. Just like a treasure. Just like something which has been put aside for you to use later on. It's quite rare that you hear words that are really, you feel, wow, that is really nice to hear. That is really beautiful. Let me keep that in my heart. Let me kind of save that for a day when I feel bad. I'll bring it out again and then use it for my benefit. And then it says also here that the words are reasonable. In other words, they are not just talk which is just not based on a solid foundation. This is talk that is based with solid reasons on a solid foundation. They are reasonable words. And then they are moderate. Moderate here means they have an end. They don't just go on and on. The Pali is pariyanta. Pariyanta means having an end. So it's not just kind of talking without stop. Okay, there is another place of the suttas where the Buddha talks about what kind of word should be spoken to other people. And the Buddha says that if something is beneficial, then it is often, it can be said. And it's not in Buddhism as if you cannot say words that are painful. Sometimes you have to say painful things, right? Things that people don't want to hear. But if it is beneficial, then if it is also the right time, then you can say things which actually may be painful for others. It's important to have a possibility, right? Sometimes people don't want to hear that, children perhaps, they don't want to hear that you shouldn't be doing this thing. But sometimes you have to tell them, okay, this you can't do. This is not right. It's good to have that opportunity, that possibility, according to the Buddhist teaching, to actually sometimes say things which people don't really want to hear. Okay, so that is the right speech. So that is the equivalent to the third factor on the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's quite hard to live up to this Buddhist teaching, right? It takes a lot of perseverance, you really have to try quite hard and practice quite hard in order to be able to do this kind of thing here. It's very detailed and goes to very refined points. And that's what the Buddha said before. He said that, what did he say again? He says here that the holy life is utterly perfect and pure, right? It takes into account this very large array of what actually is moral conduct. Okay, so then comes a long section in here, which is mostly relevant for monastics. I'm just going to drop that out because it's not all that interesting. Everything is interesting in my opinion, but it's not maybe as interesting as some of the other stuff. So we'll just leave it out for now. And then just to make sure that we have a time to go through all the things we want to go through. So we'll drop one paragraph and go down to the next paragraph about contentment. Okay, so this goes as follows. So again, we are talking about monastic life, and this reads as follows. He becomes content with robes to protect his body and with alms food to protect his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out, taking only these with him. Just as a bird, wherever it goes, flies with its wings as its only burden, so too the monk becomes content with robes to protect his body and with alms food to maintain his stomach. And wherever he goes, he sets out, taking only these with him. Possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, he experiences within himself a bliss that is blameless. So here we are, in a sense, coming to the what could be considered the right livelihood for a monastic. So the right livelihood for a monastic is practicing the monastic path and then relying on people supporting you on that basis. And here we're also moving from the, like, the external morality, the morality of body and morality of speech, and we're now moving into the area of morality of the mind. Because, and the reason for that is because if you are content, right? If you, content is the opposite of desire. So if you are content with what you have, it means that you are dampening down the desires. When you dampen down the desires, you also dampen down the ill will. Because ill will and anger is often just the opposite, is the counterpart to desire. So as a monastic, you are just content with just the robes and your bowl, and you don't need anything more than that. So if you go forth and you become a monk or a nun for the right reason, then you will tend to be happy with that, because you have done this on purpose, right? And it's the same thing, you can also apply this in lay life, it doesn't just apply in monastic life. So in lay life, it's the same kind of thing. If you are happy with what you have, of course you have a few more things, you may have a house, you have a car perhaps, you have whatever. But as long as whatever you have, as long as you are content with that, you don't necessarily want any more, you don't want to increase what you have, you will have a similar kind of contentment that you can find in monastic life. And there's something beautiful about that. If you are content with what you have, that's already a sense of peace, right? This urge of always moving forward, always getting something else, getting a new partner in life, getting a new car, whatever. When that subsides and you're happy with what you have, there's already quite an important sense of peace right there. There's a beautiful verse in the Dhammapada which says that contentment is the highest wealth. Why is that? Why is contentment the highest wealth? Well, the reason is because it doesn't matter how wealthy you are. If you want more, you haven't got enough, right? And you see that even sometimes people who are very wealthy, it doesn't matter, still they want more. Still they want more power, more, you know, larger bank account. I remember reading this terrible story many years ago. There was a famous American stockbroker called Ivan Boesky, and he was this was back in the 1980s. And he was doing very well. And, you know, in the United States, they have this list of the richest people, right? So they have the 500 richest people in the world or something. And one year, he was at the bottom of that list, right? 500. And he said to his wife, "This is the last time you see me at the bottom of this list." And I recently read another story. This was one of the princes in Saudi Arabia. And he, the richest man in the Middle East, so you can imagine how rich that person is. It's very, very, very wealthy. And he, again, he was also on one of these lists, and he was, I think, number 20 in the world or something, the richest people. But they had put him down as being worth $20 billion. And then he called up the magazine and said, "No, I'm worth more than that. This is how much I'm worth, 25 or 27 or whatever." It's quite sad, isn't it? I mean, it's funny, but it's also quite sad in a sense. You know, you are so wealthy. You can do anything you want in the world, but still, it's not enough. And this is why contentment is the highest wealth. Because when you are content, you don't need anything more. And that's why it is the highest wealth. Okay, so at this point, if you have that sense of contentment in your life, you actually feel so much more peaceful. You feel so much more at ease. And this is, of course, why this, we're now moving into the territory of the mind. The purification of the mind begins here. And it's very nice, this monastic ideal, right? All you have is you have your bowl and you have your robes. And then you travel around, and that's enough. at the time of the Buddha, it was even better because then you could just, you know, stay outside. You could maybe sleep, you know, in the forest, and then you would go into the village and you would receive food. But it's still possible to live a little bit like that in the present day. But interesting also the way it says here that that bowl and that robe is still considered a burden, right? Just like the wing, the bird, which has its wings as its only burden. In the same way, the bowl and the robe, they're still a kind of burden. Even though you have reduced the burden a lot, there's still a little bit left. So the idea is like, as long as you have something to look after, whether it is your bowl and robe, even if it's just your body, as long as there's something you have to look after, there's some degree of burden there. And it's only when you go into very deep meditation that the burden disappears altogether. So that's why this is now moving towards that, the path is moving towards that depth of meditation. So then it says here that possessing this aggregate of noble virtue, word aggregate is a terrible word in my opinion. It doesn't sound real, right? It sounds like, but basically what it means, possessing all of these types of noble virtue together, you feel inside of yourself, you feel the bliss, a bliss of blamelessness, a bliss that is blameless. And that bliss of blamelessness is a negative kind of bliss in the sense that you don't feel any shame or you don't feel anything bad inside of yourself because you have done the wrong things. You have a sense of purity inside of yourself. But it's also a positive bliss in the sense that you also feel happy because of the good things you have done. So this is where you're building up the foundation for meditation to become possible. And this is why I was saying yesterday that if you just do things like mindfulness practice, the sort of modern practices that you hear about, particularly coming out of the United States, if you just focus on that, and you lack all these other aspects of the path, you're not going to go very far. It may be a little bit beneficial, but only a little bit. It's not going to take you to the same depth, the same profundity. This path is much, much more profound than these modern types of practices that you see. Okay, so now that is then the contentment. So we are now moving into the mental realm. So you're already abandoning a lot of the desires, a lot of the aversion. And the next paragraph now is on what is called sense restraint. And this is to further reduce desires and negativity and ill will in the mind. Okay, so this is what it reads like. So on seeing a form with the eye, he does not grasp at its signs and features. Since if he left the eye faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. He practices the way of its restraint. He guards the eye faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the eye faculty. On hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind. So the same thing for every sense, right? The same kind of idea. On cognizing a mind object with the mind, he does not grasp at its signs and features, since if he left the mind faculty unguarded, evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief might invade him. He practices the way of his restraint. He guards the mind faculty. He undertakes the restraint of the mind faculty. Possessing this noble restraint of the faculties, he experiences within himself a bliss that is unsullied. Okay, so I'm going to explain this because this is not very, very obvious. The way the English translation here, how it's done in English, is actually not that obvious what it means. So seeing a form with the eye, it just means any visual impression on the eye, right? So whenever you have a visual impression, it says here, you don't grasp the signs and the features. Now, signs and features, the word sign here is not easy to understand. What it actually means is that you don't grasp any object. That's actually what it means. So any kind of object you see with the eye, and then the word feature means like a smaller aspect of that thing. So if you see a person, you might like the whole person, or you might like a kind of an aspect of that person, like, you know, the hair or the eyes or something like that. So the meaning is very simple, but what it just means, that you don't actually grasp onto anything that you see through the eyes. That's basically what it means. So what is the meaning of grasping here? And the meaning of grasping is that when you see something, instead of actually letting it go, you are attracted or you are repelled by what you are seeing. So it sticks in your mind, right? You see something beautiful, and then when you turn away, you look somewhere else. It sticks in your mind. It's still there. That is what grasping means. And then you think about it afterwards, right? You can't get rid of it. It's kind of stuck in your mind. Very hard to get it out again. So this is what we're trying to avoid here. Trying to avoid things sticking in your mind. So when you sit in the meditation, what you think about is all those things that you have seen, because they are particularly kind of the beautiful things or attractive things, because basically you have grasped them. So this is what it means then, to guard the eye faculty. It means that you avoid that kind of grasping here. So guarding the eye, to be able to guard the eye, requires two things. It requires a certain degree of mindfulness, or awareness if you like. You have to be aware of what is happening. That's the first thing. And when you have that awareness there, you're able to see that, you know, I'm about to desire something, I'm about to become averse to something. And when you see that, you can actually take the counteraction to stop that from happening. And what is that counteraction? Well, that counteraction is just to remind yourself that you don't want that. I don't want to get angry. I don't want to go there. Why? Because you know it's going to be painful. And this, we'll talk about that later on. It's painful for you. It's painful for others. It creates all kinds of problems. So just by reminding yourself of that is enough to stop you from going down that road of getting upset or having a desire which is not useful. So guarding the eye faculty is a combination of mindfulness and wisdom. And when you have that combination, then you are, that is how this thing called sense restraint that we're talking about now, that's how it happens. And then when you have that sense restraint, then these things that are called here evil, unwholesome states of covetousness and grief. What this means is, evil is not a very good word, let's say bad, unwholesome states, like mental qualities. So bad, unwholesome mental qualities of covetousness and greed, it just means of desire and aversion, right? You either like something you see or you dislike it. If you like it, you get desire. If you dislike it, you get aversion. So this is what is meant by bad, unwholesome qualities. Dislike and like, aversion and attraction. So this is what sense restraint is about. It's important to understand this, because sometimes you get this feeling that the word like restraint in English, it sounds like you're using force, right? You're restraining yourself, you're holding back. But actually, this is one of the, I think, most important things about the Dhamma practice. The practice of Dhamma is mostly about wisdom. It's how you think, how you reflect about things. It's much, much more important than using other willpower. So I'll talk much more about this afterwards, how to reflect in a wise way, because this is one of the very foundational things of Dhamma practice. Okay, so then it is, of course, the eye is a very important faculty. A lot of the impressions in life that come through the eye, but this is also true for all the senses, all the six senses here, including the mind. Maybe a small point here, it says the word eye faculty. What does the word eye faculty mean? What it means is slightly different from the eye. When you think about the eye, it's just a physical thing, right? The idea of eye faculty is like the whole thing which enables you to see anything. So it includes the whole apparatus, if you like, of seeing, which is included here. So you're not actually restraining the physical eye. What you are restraining is the activity of seeing. That's quite different. So, and then the last one is the mind as well. So whenever you think something, it's exactly the same thing, right? Even thinking can give rise to desire or aversion, just like anything that comes through the five senses. So the mind is also included here. And then when you have this particular restraint of the faculties, then you experience the bliss inside of you, which is unsullied. It is a bit like, you can imagine, unsullied here means like uncontaminated, right? So even though you are a good person, even though you're doing all the right things, if you have desire and anger in the mind, it's like that. Those defilements, they contaminate the happiness that you have. So you are purifying the happiness. And it's this pure happiness, again, the more pure the happiness is, the more unsullied it is, the more power it has to take you into deep states of meditation. Okay, so that is sense restraint. And this is a very important aspect of the Dhamma. So one now having gotten to this point, I'm going to stop with this particular sutta, and I will move on to these other suttas, which are further behind here, and talk about how to deal with anger, how to deal with desire, and these kind of things. This is the next topic coming up, which will have to be after lunch today. So please, if you have any questions about what I have said today, I'm sure that some of the things I have said are probably quite controversial and things, so please put those things in the box, and then we can discuss these things this evening. Okay, so continue having fun, and we'll see you later on.